Welcome everyone to today's internet seminar. My name is Jean Balance and I'll be serving as the online moderator for today's session, coming to you from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. I'm going to kick off today's CEC Preliminary Assessment and Site Inspection, or PASI, webinar series, module number 6. Today's module will look at the PA scoring exercise, in particular focusing on soil exposure and air migration pathways. In just a moment, I'll turn things over to our two instructors today, Jody McCarty and Therese Joya from Tetra Tech, Inc. But before I do that, let me walk through a few session reminders for those of you who are joining us for the live broadcast. As we have with the others in the series, you should have received a registration reminder email for today's module number 6 delivery. You will receive a unique email for each module in the series, so make sure you're referring to the correct email when trying to join us today. That email will have all of the instructions you'll need to join us and will ultimately point you to something known as the seminar homepage. Once you click on the link to the homepage, you'll be able to read more about the session. At the top of each homepage, we are including links to the recorded modules in the series, so we do have complete recordings for modules 1 through 5 available on today's homepage. If you had any problems last Friday with the Module 5 delivery, please know we did get a complete recording. We do have the full audio recording, so the MP3 file is the entire session. And then we do have like a 99% complete Adobe Connect recording. We're missing about 1 to 1.5 minutes in Adobe Connect, but if you can't follow along, again, we do have that complete audio or MP3 file available to download as well. You'll also find links to download the presentation materials and participant manuals that we'll be using for today. There's links to the feedback form. There's also contact information for instructors. But for now, you'll want to click a button labeled Go to Seminar. Once you do that, you'll be asked to identify yourself by name as well as the number of people at your location, and then you'll be successfully checked in online to our interactive Adobe Connect delivery. Again, with Adobe Connect, you'll be able to watch in real time as we deliver our session, as well as interact using a series of polls that will be popping up on the screen today. If you have problems joining us online in Adobe Connect, you can simply download the participant manual and follow along on the phone lines, but we do encourage you to let us know if you're having difficulties so we can troubleshoot it and get you on board with Adobe Connect. Audio is available online by default, so everyone can listen to the session online using your computer speakers or headphones. If you have problems with the online audio, the first thing I'll ask you to do is make sure that that green speaker icon is shaded bright green. If it's not, click it to turn it on. And then if that doesn't solve the problem, check your own local volume settings on your computer or mobile device. Sometimes it's just a matter of boosting the speaker output to get things working. If that doesn't solve the problem, we do have toll-free call-in information for those who need it. Simply use the Q&A window in the lower right to request it, and I'll be more than happy to share that call-in information. Just know if you join us on the phones, you will be globally muted, and we ask that you remain globally muted to cut down on background noises and other audio disruptions. Q&A will be handled with the Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. There's already a few welcome messages for me. Feel free to take a moment if you haven't done so already and send in a quick test message so that you can be familiar with how the Q&A window works. Just send in a message and let me know how the audio and visuals are working from your location. Throughout today's broadcast, you'll be able to type up questions and comments using that exact same method by clicking on the empty box at the very bottom of the Q&A window, typing up your question or comment, and then hitting enter or pressing the cartoon bubble to the right, and that will privately submit the message in. We will take designated breaks, and at that point, I'll read the questions out loud so that our instructors can answer them. You are highly encouraged to submit your questions and comments at any time. There's no need to wait. And feel free, again, if you're having technical problems or have logistics-related issues, to send those into the Q&A window as well. Today's session is being recorded and will be shared via email as soon as we can with the live delivery. Again, we do have modules 1 through 5 available, so if anyone is missing those modules, feel free to use the Q&A window to let me know. We'll be more than happy to get it to you. And again, we do have nearly 600 archived internet seminars that you're more than welcome to browse and replay on demand. So you will see a copy of the presentation material appear here. We will control movement through those slides. There's a button in the upper right corner. Looks like these four arrows pointing in opposite directions. You can click that button at any time to make the slides bigger and click it a second time to shrink them back down. In the middle right, we have a collection of related URLs. Those are all active hyperlinks. So on the seminar homepage, you'll find the module recordings from sessions 1 through 5. And on the seminar resources page, you'll find the links to the participant handout and other materials we'll be using during today's broadcast. To open up a link of interest, simply click it and press the Browse To button to open them up. And then, of course, that all-important Q&A window in the lower right corner, you can type in your questions and comments here and hit Enter or press the cartoon bubble to the right to privately submit. As mentioned earlier, we are kicking off with module number 6 today. We will carry on with module 7 on July 21st and then conclude the entire series with the last module number 9 on July 30th. So if you haven't registered for all of the modules, take a moment to do so after today's live broadcast to make sure you join us for the remainder of the series. Participants are encouraged to take all 9 modules and to do so in numerical order to receive full credit. Although you don't necessarily need to take all 9 live, you do need to complete all 9 to get full credit for the series. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So I'm going to pull up the PowerPoint slides for today's instructor. And I'm going to turn things over to our very first instructor, Therese Joya from Tetra Tech. Therese, whenever you're ready.
All right. Thanks, Jean. And welcome, everyone. Today we'll finish up with our preliminary scoring of the ABC vacuum site. We'll take a look at the soil pathway. I'll be doing that one. And then Jody McCarty will take over and walk you through the air pathway. So for the soil pathway, about 15%, that's 15% of sites on the NPL actually score the soil exposure pathway. So it's not scored a lot, but significant enough that, you know, if you have a site that will only score on the soil exposure pathway, you would definitely want to consider that. So let's see what the soil exposure pathway is all about. It really looks at target populations that are coming into direct contact with hazardous substances. So it's looking at exposure to known hazardous substances in a defined area. And the rules for how you define those areas of hazardous substances is spelled out, and you have to follow them in order to score this particular pathway. It is why it's called a soil exposure pathway and not a soil migration pathway, because it is looking at chemical analysis, that sort of data to define these areas, and then sort of postulate about who or what might come in contact with those contaminated areas. So it's looking at both contaminated soil associated with the sources at your site as well as the sources themselves. There's a pretty easy way to actually include all of the sources you have at your site as these defined areas called areas of observed contamination. And then you have the same issues associated with attribution in the soil pathway that you do in the other pathways. And some would argue maybe even a little more so. In the soil pathway, you know, you have to find by chemical analysis that you have an observed release and that it defines your area of observed contamination. And this definition can sometimes involve contaminants and does a lot, metal contamination. And these metal contaminants also occur naturally. And so background becomes a big issue with the soil exposure pathway. You really do need to attribute the increase in what you see above background to your site, and then you have to deal with the issue of what is background for your particular contaminants. It not only affects contaminants that occur naturally, it also affects very ubiquitous contaminants that don't really occur naturally, but they're everywhere, and so they may affect your background numbers. As you can see from this last bullet, it also includes not just soil itself, but any other media that might have become contaminated. So if you have gravel or waste piles or asphalt or flooring or concrete that's in the top 2 feet, it is contaminated by site activity, then those media can be considered areas of observed contamination or AOCs. So there was a question when we went over Module 2 about whether or not you could evaluate a contaminated media if it wasn't soils in the soil exposure pathway. And the answer to that is yes, although just as with the soil in the soil exposure pathway, with some other contaminated media, you need to be able to sample it and say that it is contaminated, that it does meet the criteria for an observed release. So the requirements for chemical analysis are still in place, even if you're not sampling soil. So So some of the questions that you should be answering as the investigator conducting either the preliminary assessment or the site inspection is to make the determination on whether or not there is observed contamination. And so you need to understand what the requirements for are in the rule for being able to say you have an area of observed contamination. So an AOC is established when you have a hazardous substance that's attributable to the site and it's present in the top 2 feet of soil at a level that is 3 times the background level for the site. So it's the top 2 feet that you're looking at, and then you're looking at the chemical analysis in the same way you do as in the other pathways, which is essentially the 3 times background requirement. Then the second prong, so there's a two-pronged sort of approach. You have to establish that you have an observed release, and then where this observed release is becomes very important for the soil exposure pathway. So it has to meet a two-pronged approach in the second bullet. You have to say that you've established your AOC on property that is also used as a residence, a school, or a daycare. So that's the first prong. The AOC is on the property. And the second prong is that the AOC is within 200 feet of a regularly occupied area of that particular property. So for a residence, it's usually the home itself. For a daycare, it could be the actual daycare facility, the building that the children are in, or possibly an outdoor area where they play for a great deal of time. And for workers, it would be, you know, the facility or the building. So those are the two prongs. The AOC is on the property, and it's within 200 feet of the regularly occupied structure or area. That's really important to understand for establishing your AOCs and counting your targets. And then we also look at what else might be happening on the AOCs. So this last bullet, what talks about resources and terrestrial sensitive environments, is really looking at the activity that is occurring in a defined AOC. So if there are the terrestrial sensitive environments that are contained in a table that occur within an AOC, you would get points for that. And the same with specific types of resources. So this is what the scoring looks like. Gene, I can't see that, seem to find the green arrow. Oh, by magic. All right, so we're going to look at likelihood of exposure, and this is akin to likelihood of release in the migration pathways. Then you look at waste characteristics, which we're really used to doing by now, and then there are two threats that are evaluated, the nearby population threat and the resident population threat. We'll look at the resident population threat first in more detail in the next couple of slides, but first notice there are lots of ways to get points in the resident population threat. Here's where all your target points are derived, and you don't see so much over in the nearby population threat. So that's just giving you a prelude to how points are established and where you really find the most points for this particular pathway. So likelihood of exposure looks at those areas you defined as your AOCs. They contain hazardous substances that aren't covered by an impenetrable cover and that occur within the top 2 feet of the ground surface. And once you define those AOCs, then you would evaluate your targets and calculate your waste characteristics. Remember, it's not limited to soils, and it's especially easy to use your other sources at the site and establish them as AOCs. What the rule says is that if you have a single sample from a source that indicates you have an observed release within that source of the contamination that you're interested in, then it is established as an AOC. So if you could say that the lagoon was contaminated at ABC Vacuum with a single sample, you could call that whole area an AOC. So don't forget about your sources on site. And then, of course, you'll want to consider the mechanisms that may have been in play when hazardous substances were transported from your sources to nearby properties that will influence what your sampling strategy looks like in the site inspection if the soil exposure pathway is carried forward. You would certainly sample an area where the contaminants came there by aerial deposition a little bit differently than you would if it was an area that just received maybe contaminated tailings as fill material. So it's important to hypothesize and look through historical records about how hazardous substances were actually transported from your site. So let's look a little bit more at how we get our population target points. In the resident population threat, you can look at residents or students or workers that are located within where the AOC is actually on their property and their residence or school is within 200 feet of the defined AOC. Same thing for workers. You can look at workers that have where an AOC is located on the facility and within 200 feet of the regularly occupied building at the facility. You also look at terrestrial sensitive environments that might be occurring within any defined AOC, as well as resources. Resources are primarily agricultural resources, and they're just like with all the other pathways, there's a table that lists the resources and ascribes points. And I think we're going to take a look at that table in just a minute. So remembering these definitions, especially this one here, let's look at a participant poll on the next slide. So here we're giving you a scenario. Let me set it up for you just so you make sure it's clear in your mind. So we have defined our area of observed contamination as everything within these large dashed lines. And then the smaller dashed line are the property boundaries for residents 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And then here you see our little distance indicator to give you an idea of a scale. So go ahead and take a look at that setup and the answers we've provided down below and pick the answer you think is best.
And just a reminder, you can vote by simply clicking on the circle to the left of the answer that best matches your own reply. In this case, we can only pick one option. And if you're having any problems voting in there, indicating which residences you would evaluate for actual contamination, you can also type in your response into the Q&A window. For those of you on a mobile device, you might find it easier to just free type the answer into the Q&A.
Right. It looks like most people are answering, and we have kind of an even split between the second, third, and fourth answer. So the correct answer is residence 1, 2, and 4. So I'm going to take the arrow here and show you why 1, 2, and 4 are. So we have the AOC, which is on their property, defined by this dashed line. So that was our first prong. And then the second prong is this actual residence likely within 200 feet of this AOC? And based on this little line, we would say yes. So we've met both prongs, and we would say residence 1 does qualify, and we could count the targets associated with residence 1. If we look at residence 2, again, we do have contamination on their property, so we met the first prong. And we're good. We're saying, yeah, you could say that we have the AOC located within 200 feet of that residence. And then for residence four, we would make the same assessment. The AOC is definitely on their property, which is a rather large piece of property, and with a really, really large house. And then we have the AOC within 200 feet of that residence. So what about residence three and five? Let's take a look at residence three. Well, they have some contamination on their property, so they meet that first prong. But they don't meet the second prong because their residence is located farther than 200 feet from that AOC. For residence five, we don't meet the first prong, right? So even though if you made a measurement, you could say that they are within 200 feet of an AOC, because that AOC does not extend onto their actual property, they would not be counted. And they would not count towards the population. All right, so hopefully that helps you to think about when to consider a residential property as being as counting towards your population or not. Another thing I'd like to say here now that I didn't take the time to address in the surface water pathway, but you remember all the way back to the groundwater pathway, I cautioned that you could not infer contamination in the groundwater pathway, that if you wanted to count a population associated with a drinking water well, you had to sample that drinking water well to determine whether or not, you know, it was contaminated before counting any population associated with it. So the groundwater pathway, you cannot infer contamination. However, in the surface water and the soil exposure pathways, you can infer contamination. You can infer level 2 contamination in an unsampled point between two level 1 sampling points. So remember that when you're going to set up your site inspection, your sampling strategy, you can infer contamination in both surface water and the soil exposure pathways. So for example, in this example, if you had another residence here and you called it residence six, residence six is located right here, and you could prove up that your AOC, even though you didn't actually have a sampling point in their particular property, if you could prove up that this AOC extended onto their property based on the sampling that occurred both here and here, then you could infer contamination on that residential six property. So that's how it would work for our soil exposure pathway. All right, let's keep going. So in the resident population threat, you are looking at how are individuals, persons exposed to AOCs on their property and within 200 feet of what they occupy, the building they occupy. In the nearby population threat, you're looking at who could travel to your AOCs and contaminate themselves. So they don't actually reside or work or go to daycare on the AOC. They would travel from where they reside to the AOC. So those are how you're generating points in this particular threat. And it's not a, and the distance that you look at is a mile, but it's not really a mile radius, it's a mile travel distance. So you have to think about that too. All right, now we're going to jump into quick score and show you how you would enter numbers into that program for our ABC vacuum site. So if you're following along, you would go ahead and click on the SE score sheet, the tab there. And then let's talk a little bit about what we have at our ABC vacuum site. So we know that we have those five residents that live quite close to the site, and there are 19 individuals associated with those five residences. We know we have no schools or daycare facilities located within 200 feet of the site. And right now we're looking mainly at our six sources as defining our AOCs. The site itself is inactive, so there are no workers there. And then through the PA, they calculated there were 10 people employed at the crayfish ponds and about 65 people located at a warehouse complex. So here we are closer into the site. You can see here are our sources. Right here, and we have our stained soil. Here are our five residences, and there's 19 people associated with these. And then looking farther out, we can see here we are, here's our site again. Here's our stained soil, those five residences, and then here is our crayfish pond, and then here are those warehouses that we talked about. And the only other population that we see very far close in is this residential area here, but that's outside the 1 mile radius and certainly outside the 1 mile travel distance. So we are going to disregard that residential area. So the first thing you need to do is determine, based on your best professional judgment, what you would assume the likelihood of exposure score to be. And then knowing that you might not have the data to prove that up now. In fact, you know you don't. You absolutely have to have chemical analyses to evaluate the soil exposure pathway. And at this point in the process, after this preliminary assessment, you don't have any analytical data. So everything we're doing here is really on our best professional judgment. So you have two choices with this drop-down menu. You either hypothesize that you have a likelihood of exposure or that you don't. And we're going to hypothesize that we do, because if you pick zero, then you would be done scoring. You wouldn't need to move on. So we're going to hypothesize that, yes, possibly we do are able to identify AOCs associated with some target population. All right, let me go back one more. And then the next thing we're going to do is fill in our area of contamination information for those six sources that we have on the site so that we can start to generate a score for this particular pathway. So when you click the AOC button here, the next screen that comes up is going to look like this. I'm just going to walk you through what the steps would be, and then I'll walk you through each of those sources. So the steps that we are going to take is to, we had already named each one of our sources AOC A through F, and we can see they appear down here. So we're going to click on each of these sources and then add information about them in order to generate our waste characteristic score. And then, once you click on that, you'll check up here and make sure this information is okay. You'll come out down here and fill out the volume in accordance with the particular source type you're looking at and hit calculate. And then over here in the SCIDM box, we will fill in our contaminants associated with that particular with the particular site and add them so that it can pick out the worst contaminant when it gets to the WC calculation. When you click on that SCIDM button, this is what the table looks like that pops up the window. So you we've done this before, but you would need to add all of your substances one by one until they appear in this box. And then you would click Add Substances for that particular AOC, and it would take you back to that original screen. All right, so now let's go through each of these sources. So in order to make the drum AOC come up, you just need to double-click it down here, and it comes up. Now we checked, we see we have our drums, and then we're going to enter 10,000 as our volume. And if you remember, that was we had 200 drums. We went with the footnote that said if you don't know exactly how big they are, you can assume 50 gallons per drum. And that's how we got that 10,000 gallons. And then, And then we would go and add all of the substances in the SCIDM table, associate them with this AOC, and move on to our next AOC. And that one is our tanks. So again, this information, I believe, starts to move over once you input it once. And then the volume of cubic yards that we had for those tanks was 10. And we calculated that by two 1,000-gallon tanks and the conversion to cubic yards from the footnote in table 2-5 gives us this 10. So we put that in, and we should get a calculated HWQ for the tanks of 4. Next, we have to think about our impoundments. So we have our lagoon and our oxidation pond. And we can see from the table 5-2 that we need volume for those particular source types when they have liquids in them. And both of our lagoon and our oxidation pond have liquids. Now, we previously evaluated them based on tier D area, but that won't do for this particular exposure pathway. So we need to estimate the volume of the lagoon and the oxidation pond so that we can score them under tier C. So you can see this is table 5-2 that gives you the divisors and the units. So we can see surface impoundment here, and we need cubic yards. And then this C footnote says use the volume measure only for surface impoundments containing hazardous substances present as liquids. So that's our situation. We have these two impoundments with their substances present as liquids. So we did the math for you. We went ahead and said we have 3,000 square feet, and we're going to assume the depth is 3 feet. And that's a safe assumption. It's not ridiculous. It's not ultra-conservative. And that would need to be proven up during the site inspection if the soil exposure pathway was one that you were going to go forward with. So when you do the math, that gives you 9,000 cubic feet. When you convert that to cubic yards, you get 333.33 cubic yards for the lagoon. You do the same thing for the 750 square feet in the oxidation pond, and you get 83.33 cubic yards. So now we're ready to plug those numbers into QuickScore. So we would call up the lagoon by double-clicking it from that table below, and we would put 333.33 and hit Calculate. If you're following along, you'll see that HWQ on this screenshot is not correct. It should be 133.3. I just have to catch up with my... Then you'll want to also check and make sure you got your substances coming up over here. Next, you would call up the oxidation pond by double-clicking it. That one was 83.33 cubic yards. Make sure your substances are in there. Hit Calculate, and it should give you an HWQ for the oxidation pond. My slides are just kind of going all over the place here. All right, here we go. Next, we would do our rubbish pile. So you would double-click it down here. It would come up. You just check and make sure this information is okay. It should be. We had 500 square feet. We are going to use area. And when you hit Calculate, you get its HWQ. And then finally, we would enter our contaminated soil. This is just 1,000 square feet, and that's all three areas added together. Got our substances over here. We hit Calculate, and we get this very small volume. If you remember, the divisor for contaminated soil is 34,000. It's that 34,000 in the soil exposure pathway also, which means you got to have a whole lot of contaminated soil to have much of a, to play much of a role in your WC. All right, so you can see here the program, the QuickScore program, picked up our most contaminated substances as being arsenic. And if you look back at those list of contaminants in Skidham, you'll see there's more than one that gives you a total of 10,000. So the program appears, once it has more than one, it just takes it in alphabetical order. So that's why we see arsenic here. And it gives us a WC of 32. All right, now we're going to move on to take a look at how we score our targets. So the first thing you score is the resident individual, and very similar to the nearest well or the nearest the HFC food chain individual. And this is being measured as the person who lives or attends school or daycare on a property with an area of observed contamination and whose residence, school, or daycare is on or within 200 feet of the area of observed contamination. So if you have that condition, you would be able to get points in the resident individual category. Let's see how that works. So first of all, you have to document that you actually have this resident individual. And then if you have level one contamination associated with that individual, you would get a score of 50. If you are have level two associated with that individual, you would get a score of 45. And if you have neither level one or level two, then you would get a zero, because that means you don't have a resident individual. You don't actually have someone living, working, going to school on an AOC and within 200 feet of that AOC. All right. So let's think about our ABC site and determine how we would score the resident individual. And at this point, you know, we recommend you be conservative, you know, worst case the scenario, or run several scenarios, worst case and best case and those in between. So in our case, we decided that we would assume that we have a level one resident individual and gave ourselves those 50 points. And there's a lot of uncertainty associated with that, I realize that, but those are the notes that we would take to potentially prove up in the site inspection if it was decided that the soil exposure pathway, you know, should go forward. So then we have to think about assigning our resident population, our level one and our level two concentrations. This works very similarly to the other pathways. So first of all, you determine the total number of resident individuals that are subject to the level one concentrations. You can either do this by an exact count or by using the average number of people per residence if you're looking at a fairly large area or AOC. And then once you add all those level one individuals up, you would multiply that sum by 10. So we've seen that now in all of the other pathways. For the level two, you would add those individuals up, round to the nearest integer, and then that just becomes level two. It has a multiplier of one. And remember that you can't count a person twice. They can't be both level one and level two. So let's think about that, how that might play itself out here at the ABC vacuum site. You could run several of these scenarios and see what it means for the pathway and the site score. So we know we have those 19 residents in the five homes adjacent to the site, and we felt like those are would most likely be located in an AOC that was established by sampling. So this level one is sort of the worst case scenario, where you assume all 19 individuals are subject to level one, And then what happens to that 19 is it gets multiplied by 10 for a total level 1 population of 190. Or you could assume the most, you know, sort of the worst case for points anyway, is that all 19 are subject to only level 2. That would give you a value of 19 because it has a multiplier of 1. But there are any number of combinations in between, sort of the worst and best case there. You might assume some of the 19 residents individuals are subject to level 2, and then, I mean, level 1, and then another. Just as long as you make these two add up to 19 before this math occurs, you could play around with the scenarios you're most comfortable with. And what's nice is with the QuickScore program, you can do that fairly quickly. So we decided to run a worst-case scenario and assume that all 19 individuals were at level 1. So then we can't count them again at level 2, and then we go on to think about workers. Now, the workers we have were at the crayfish pond and the warehouse, fairly far away from the site. We weren't real comfortable saying they were located on an AOC, and so we scored workers as a 0 for our ABC vacuum site. And then we would look at resources. So we have AOCs associated with the site, mainly with our sources. And we have to ask ourselves, are resources being used in any one of those AOCs? We decided no. I mean, there is silviculture being done at the crayfish farms, but that silviculture has to be occurring on an AOC itself. So we said no at this point. And then are there any terrestrial-sensitive environments located on any of our AOCs? We said no for that also. This is the type of resources you could evaluate. Once again, for ABC vacuum, we said no. And the point value you get is either 5 or 0. You either have it or you don't. So now the program is totaling up our resident population threat score. You can see that total is right here. It's based on primarily these 50 points we gave ourselves for level 1 resident individual, and counting all 19 residences as being subject to level 1 contamination. Now, one thing I'd like to say about level 1 and level 2 contamination before I move on is that EPA, whenever you don't have a benchmark for a particular contaminant, you can only evaluate level 2 contamination. And a very common soil contaminant that does not have a benchmark in Skidham is lead. And EPA has been working to try to establish a lead benchmark so that level 1 concentrations could be evaluated. And if you may have noticed, they did publish a value in Skidham sometime this year and then quickly removed that value. And they're still working on it. So keep paying attention to Skidham, and I think EPA does really want to publish a lead benchmark. So keep on the lookout for that. My slides are just kind of, all right. So let's move on now to that other threat, which is the nearby population threat. The first thing that you evaluate is the attractiveness and accessibility value that you would assign your AOCs. So these are your defined areas of contamination, and you see the description of what these AOCs are like in terms of their attractiveness and accessibility is on the left-hand side, and then point values are assigned for all of those descriptions on the right-hand side. This is pretty subjective. You subjectively come to one of these numbers, And, you know, we always have pretty heated discussions in our classrooms about, you know, should it be a 75, maybe it's a 25, no, it looks more like a 50. And you'll see, in terms of scoring, it really doesn't make that much of a difference. So we settled here for the ABC vacuum site on our 50 value. And we would assign it a 50 from a drop-down menu. So it goes right here in that box, right here on line 12. And then you have to estimate the area of contamination, how large it is, your areas of contamination all added together, and then you go to a table and you see what range you fall in to award yourself a point value for line 13. So since we did this in QuickScore, it figured that out for us, but we're going to show you the table that it pulled the value from. So this is table 5-7 in the rule itself. So you would add up all your AOCs and get a total square foot or square footage, and then compare that to where you fall in the table. And the way it was calculated here is that we had these values from our various AOCs and ended up being about 5,250 square feet, which plopped us right in here. Notice the ranges are very large, but anytime you're near a breakpoint, you want to make sure your calculation is going to withstand scrutiny. So this is at 5,250. You would want to make sure about that number, especially if this has any meaning in terms of the site score. All right, so then you can see the program took all of our WC information and populated it over on this side. We still have our waste characteristic score of 32. Next, we're going to move on to look at the targets associated with the nearby population threat. And that's evaluating populations within a mile travel distance of the AOCs. So if you have a resident individual and you have scored anything, either a 45 or a 50 for resident individual over in the resident population threat, you automatically get a 0 in the nearest individual. If you had not scored a resident individual, you would measure the shortest overland distance from the nearest resident school or daycare and assign a value based on table 5-9. So for ABC, we did evaluate the residential individual, so this would be scored as a 0 for ABC. See, we put that in there. And then you need to estimate population within a mile. And that looks at, again, this is travel distance, a mile travel distance. And it's divided into these three distance rings. And each of these distance rings are weighted. The population is weighted. So then you would sum all of your distance-weighted populations together, and that would be your first whammy that you have to distance weight. And then the second whammy is that dividing by 10 or multiplying by 0.1. That's the second whammy that we see in potential population in other pathways. So for our worker scenario here, we went with saying that we did not have any workers. If you were going to evaluate workers, you'd be doing it from the crayfish pond and from these warehouses. You would have to figure out the travel distance, and that's mainly travel by roads. So you would look at travel by road to get into the facility and exposed to the AOCs. And then you would distance weight that population. It isn't very fruitful. We went with a value of 0. If we actually calculated based on those 75 people, it would give us a value of 0.03, I do believe. So you can see the program is going to do the division for you and the math, so you would put your raw numbers in here. But like I said, we figured we'd have zero. And so our nearby population threat score is zero. It usually doesn't contribute very much at all to the soil exposure pathway. You really get most of your points from the resident population threat, not the nearby population threat. So here you can see we have our score of 51.20 for the pathway with our very worst case assumptions. It's 51.20 for the pathway, and you need a score of 57 for a pathway in order to score the site based on that pathway alone. Excuse me. I'm going to look at two more scenarios that we used. We plugged into QuickScore. When you assume all 19 of those residences are level 2, you can see the score drops, the pathway score drops from 51 and change to 14.72. So that has a big impact, lowering the target number. I just want to note, we should have changed this to a 45. And then if you split it up and say, well, maybe 4 people were level 1 and the rest, 15, were level 2, you end up with a score of 22.4. So it just gets lower the more you take out of the level 1 population category. All right, Jean, I think we'll open it up for questions.
Okay, so at this point, we're going to go ahead and start taking some of the electronic questions that have been submitted. If you haven't typed one in yet, go ahead and use the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen, and we'll submit, or you can type up your message, click the little cartoon bubble to the right, or press the Enter key on your keyboard and submit your question in. We do have a few that came in. We'll start with those. The first one is asking in reference to slide 6-21. In QuickScore, is there a place to document the assumptions, such as the one that the lagoon is 3 feet deep?
Yeah, you could use the scratch pad to take notes and organize your references and document that that's an assumption that would need to be checked. So I think the scratch pad feature is where you would put that.
Okay. And our next question, does a designated recreational area that clearly does not get much use get assigned 100 in the table 5-6?
No, I'd have to look at 5-6. I'm going to 5-6, sorry.
Okay. So we're pulling up table 5-6. And again, the question was, does a designated recreational area that clearly does not get much use get assigned a 100 based on that table?
I think if it's a designated recreational area that you probably would go ahead and assign 100. Like I said, the nearby population threat usually doesn't generate a whole lot of points, and so, you know, spending a whole lot of time determining the value here is usually not well spent.
Okay. Our next question, is contaminated soil considered when the level of contamination is 3 times the level of a pollutant detection?
It depends on what the pollutant is. So it's you need to demonstrate an observed release. And in order to demonstrate the observed release, it's 3 times background if you have a detection of that particular whatever compound you're interested in the background sample. Or if you don't, then you just have to exceed the sample quantitation limit for the sample. Equal or exceed the sample quantitation limit. So it depends on the contaminant and whether it is considered to occur in background or occurring in the background sample.
Okay. We did also have just another comment when you had the first poll question up with the different areas and you asked them to vote which ones they would test for contamination. One person just commented that on the map they misinterpreted the drawing because they thought the 200-foot line was a scale. They didn't know it was a scale. They thought it was the orange dashed line. So in other words, the area of concentration plus 200 feet. So it was just the different dash sizes on the illustration kind of threw them off.
Okay.
So just putting that out there. So if anybody else had a similar confusion over the illustration, point noted, and we will take that back to the training materials team to let them know. Well, I don't see any other questions coming in, so I think we can go ahead and carry on with the training. But for participants, you all can continue to type up those questions and comments using the Q&A window in the lower right corner of the screen.
Okay, thank you, Jean, and thank you, Teresa. So this is Jody McCarty, and I'll be going over the air migration pathway. So we'll go ahead and get started on that. So in the air pathway, if you remember, we're looking at the likelihood of release, and then our waste characteristics, which is made up of the toxicity and mobility and the hazardous waste quantity. And then in the air pathway, our targets that we're evaluating are the human population, resources that are available, and then any sensitive environments. So when we're looking at our site assessment, what are the questions that we want to make sure that we're answering? So in the air migration pathway, we're asking ourselves, how likely is it that the hazardous substances we have associated with our site and our sources are being released into the air from those site sources? And then would we be able to detect those hazardous substances through air sampling, so sampling the air in or around the site? As most of you guys probably know, collecting air samples can be a costly effort. There can be complications with it if you're not documenting your weather conditions, if the weather conditions change, if you don't happen to sample for the appropriate amount of time, or maybe you're not using even the right media to sample. Before you take on an effort like this, you want to make sure that you really do have the information to move forward to get good data, and that you're going to be able to document that you do have hazardous substances that are being released into the air. We're also wanting to see who is going to be affected by this, who and what. So what are our potential targets? You want to evaluate and identify all of those for the air pathway. This would include residents, any workers, any people that attend school that are within a four miles of our site sources. So in the air pathway, we're looking at a target distance limit of 4 miles. If we have resources, we want those must be within a half mile of our sources. And then the sensitive environments that we're evaluating, those must be within our 4 miles of the site sources. Now, the air pathway, it usually is not used too often to score a site. It's usually scored about 7% of the time. So really, the air pathway, you're really only pursuing it if it is the only pathway you have available to score. So the first thing that we looked at is the likelihood of release. We look at this a little bit differently than the other migration pathways. Again, at this stage, during the preliminary assessment stage, we're looking to see if we should even pursue the air pathway during our site inspection, if we have enough information, if we can show that there's the likelihood that our hazardous substances are being released into the air. If we cannot document that we have an observed release, then, like in our other pathways, we would evaluate the potential to release, and we'd score that. In the air migration pathway, that is scored on evaluating both the gaseous and then the particulate hazardous substances, and then you use the hazardous substance that yields the highest score once you evaluate it both as a gas and then as a particulate. So for our targets, this can include people that are living, they're going to school, or they work within that 4-mile TDL of our sources. The sensitive environments, these are also within that 4-mile TDL. These are also included as targets, and they can include wetlands. There's also other areas that are designated as sensitive environments, and these are in HRS Table 4-23, so you'd want to refer to that table when you're evaluating the air migration pathway. And some of those are if it's a national park, a national monument, if it's a habitat that is used by a federal or state designated endangered or threatened species. So there's a whole entire list of what qualifies as a sensitive environment, and then what the points are based on what that area is designated as. And again, that's in HRS Table 4-23. And then we mentioned, too, that there's resources that are included as targets in the air pathway. This can include commercial agriculture or silviculture, or if it's a major or designated recreational area. But just remember that those resources have to be within a half a mile of the sources to be counted as a target. So we'll take a look at this figure, and then I think we'll do a little quiz. You'll see here, as I said, that the air pathway is a 4-mile target distance limit. Excuse me. We have 6 different rings that we evaluate. We have the 0 to quarter mile, quarter to half, half to 1, and then 1 to 2 miles, 2 to 3 miles, and then the 3 to 4-mile target distance limit. As with anything, if we're looking at the potential, if we're looking at populations that are subject to potential contamination, these get distance weighted just like they do in all the other pathways. So what we're going to take a look at here, and some of you guys have already started voting, we're going to put out a scenario that we have an observed release that occurred from our site, which, just like on a treasure map, X marks the spot. And we collected a sample out in the 2 to 3 mile distance ring. So right in this area, somewhere in here, we collected a sample. And so what population would you evaluate as actual contamination? So our first option is the entire population within 3 miles, so from our source up to the 3-mile TDL. Because the release occurred at the site and traveled up to 3 miles away where the sample was collected? Or would you only count the population within the 2 to 3 mile distance ring because that's the location of the sample? So it looks like a good deal of you guys are voting, and we appreciate that. We'll just give you maybe one more second as I see if the numbers keep going up. All right, so we'll go ahead and those of you that selected that the entire population within 3 miles of the source gets counted. So if you remember from our lectures, as long as you collect that sample, wherever you collect that sample from, you can collect everything. You can count all the populations from there into the source. So for this example, you'd get to collect any populations that are within the site all the way out to the 3-mile target distance limit. So good job for that 84% that got that correct. All right, so when we're looking at our human population targets, again, you're going to want to take and you want to make sure that you're identifying the population that is on your site as well in each one of the 6 distance rings. That are associated within your 4-mile TDL. You can either use different databases that house population information, or you could base it on you could do an individual house count, and then use county information to get the average number of people per house, and you could do that. You could use that information to get what your population is per distance ring. I was thinking too, as Therese was talking, you could even nowadays use, you know, Google Earth. We talked about some of the desktop information available to during the PA, and Google Earth would be a good way to get an idea of how many houses are in each target distance ring, and then that could always be verified when you go out to do the site inspection. You could make sure that those houses are still there or that there aren't more houses that are now in that area. You're also going to want to identify any workers or student populations that are within that TDL, especially the ones that are within a half a mile of the site, only because once you get past a half a mile, the distance weighting really does take effect. And so unless you have something like a large university or even like a large business, you know, a GE or something like that, that's more than a half a mile away, it probably isn't worth your time, or you won't get a lot of points, we should say, past that half-mile mark if you're just looking at, you know, a few residences here and there. And then again, remember the PA, this is readily available information that's right at your fingertips, so it should be pretty easy to obtain and then pretty quick to do. You shouldn't have to spend a lot of time getting your populations. So the nearest individual, when we look at the nearest individual, this is really looking at who are the people that are most likely to be exposed or who have the biggest threat to be exposed to our hazardous substance that's being released into the air. Just like in other pathways, if you do have a nearest individual that is subject to level one contamination, you get a value of 50. If you have a nearest individual who's subject to level 2, that gets you a 45. And then after that, if you're looking at potential, then it's going to be based on how the distance that they are from the actual source. excuse me, the nearest individual, this is the closest person to any source located at the site, and it can also be represented by the nearest regularly occupied building. That could be a business, it could be a school, or it could be a daycare. So our populations, again, this should look pretty familiar. We have level one, level two, and then potential, which, you know, gets that distance weighted taken into effect that can really, you know, lower your score. For level one and level two concentrations, you're going to be, you know, using your best professional judgment to determine who is subject to level one and level two. Just like in other pathways, if you have level one concentrations, then you get to multiply that number by 10, and that becomes your level one. Level two populations, they don't get multiplied or divided by anything, so that's just your standard, whatever your count is, that's your level two concentrations. And then for potential, again, you're identifying your residents, workers, and students that are within that 4 miles of the site. And then the population that's associated with each one of those rings that we saw in that example, each one of those is distance weighted. And then, of course, as Therese likes to call it, that double whammy, you add those distance weighted populations together, but then you have to divide that by 10. So that's your second hit that you're getting if you have to evaluate potential contamination. So again, that kind of shows you why you're determining the population in each ring, because each one is going to be distance weighted by a different factor, and then you're going to add all of those up. So you want to try to get the most accurate count that you can, especially since you're going to have to divide that by 10. So as we mentioned, we also look at resources and sensitive environments as targets in the air pathway. So again, our resources, this can be commercial agriculture or silviculture, or if it's a major or designated recreation area. But again, if you have one of these resources, it must be within a half a mile of your of the sources that are at your site. And then your sensitive environments, these are within the 4-mile TDL. And again, they're evaluated, both actual and potential contamination. And again, that potential contamination is going to be subject to distance weighting, just like always. So let's go ahead and we'll look at actually scoring the air pathway for the ABC site. We'll just, I'll walk you through how we scored it, and then we have a few different scenarios to show you how, if you assume that we have some level A, or level A, sorry, I had my mind on emergency response, I guess, for a second. If you have some level one or level two populations, how that might affect your how that might affect your score. So it looks like we have another quiz here. So we'll go ahead and we'll do this one. Let's say that we have an air release that has been documented within the 0 to 0.25 mile distance ring. We have counted and we have 19 residents that live in that distance ring. We also have contaminated soil that's located on the residential properties, and the residents are evaluated as resident individuals. So are we double counting targets if we evaluate the 19 residents as actual contamination in both the soil exposure and air migration pathways? And it's a pretty simple yes or no. All right, so it looks like we're still voting. All right, looks like we've slowed down a little bit. So we'll go ahead and close this one out, and the answer is B, well, no. So you'll remember that we would not be double counting our targets here, because the 19 residents, we're evaluating them in two different pathways, the soil exposure and the air migration pathway, and their risk to that contamination is evaluated in two different ways. You know, we evaluated in the soil and we evaluated in the air in two different ways. So we would not be double counting our targets since we're looking at two different pathways there. So good job. Good job to everybody. And thank you again for voting. We appreciate it. So we'll go ahead and we'll take a look here at the Quick Score program. So in this one, we would go ahead and we'd open up our air score sheet right here. And for the ABC vacuum site, using our best professional judgment, we are going to say that the substances that we have most likely would not be detected in any air samples, and so based on that, we are going to say that we would not have an observed release. So we're going to give that a score of 0, which means if we are not scoring it on an observed release, then we're going to have to score it on potential to release. So we'll go ahead and we'll walk through that. Now this is a table, because if you remember at the beginning of the air pathway lecture, we said that if you're going to score on potential to release, you have to score, you have to evaluate both gaseous potential to release as well as particulate potential to release. So first we're going to look at the gas potential to release. So this little table, it's just a work table. It's not necessarily something that you'll go find, but it's something that you can use for each one of your sites. And this will help you come up with what your the potential to release is if you're evaluating it on gas potential. So for each one of your sources that you have associated with this pathway, you're going to come up with a gas containment value, a gas source type value, and then gas migration potential value. And these are all of those are based on information and based on tables that you can find in the HRS. So when you get that information out of the HRS, you'll have a containment factor value for each one, you'll have your source type factor value, and then you'll have your gas migration potential factor value. You'll add B and C together for each one. And then you will take that sum of B and C and multiply it by your gas containment factor value. So that'll get you your gas potential likelihood to release value by source. So you'll do that for all of your sources. And you'll notice that for your gas potential to release, it's your surface impoundment that is giving you, yielding the highest score. But you'll also remember that we need to do this for particulates as well. So here's our particulate potential to release. And you'll see we do it very similar. You look at the sources that are associated with your pathway, what type it is. You'll get your particulate containment factor value, then your source type factor value, your migration potential factor value for particulates. Again, you'll take B plus C, and then you will multiply that by A, by your particulate containment factor value. And then you will get, you'll look and see what yields your highest particulate potential likelihood to release by source. And for the particulates, it turns out to be the ditches, which are your contaminated soil, and that yields you a score of 280. So then you'll go back into QuickScore, and you'll see that on line 2A, your gas potential to release, you'll remember we got a 450 for that. For the particulate potential to release, we had our highest was 280. So then on line 2C, your potential to release will get you 450 points. And QuickScore should do this for you. When you put in both of your values, QuickScore should pick the higher value. So your likelihood of release score becomes 450 based on your gas potential to release. Then the next thing that we'll look at is our mobility value. This comes out of HRS Table 613 for the air pathway. And again, these values are in SCDM, where we go to get all of our different values. So we'll go ahead, and here is where you would open up SCDM. You would choose your substances in here, and then you would select based on the substance characteristics and the site information, you would have to choose a mobility type. So either is it gas mobility, is it particulate mobility, is it a particulate observed release? So based on the information that you have and what you know about your hazardous substance, you would select one of these. And then also in the air pathway, you have to assign a particulate mobility value. And this you just select from the drop-down menu, and this comes out of the directly out of the HRS. There's a map, if you guys will remember from previous lectures, that has different regions of the country, and they're color-coded. And you'll need to find your area and then select your particulate mobility value. So for this particular site, ABC Vacuum, we're in Louisiana, and Louisiana has a particulate mobility of 0.00008. So under this number 3, that's the value that you would assign. And then you would go ahead and you would click save and return to your score sheet. And then you can see that it went ahead and selected TCE. That gave us the highest air toxicity and mobility value, which gave us a hazardous waste quantity of 100. Well, and then our waste characteristics comes out to be 18. If you're going along with this, or if you tried this on your own, benzene also had the same toxicity and mobility as TCE. This time the program just picked TCE as the one that it moved forward with. But again, since they had the same result, even if it went through with benzene, you'd still come out with the same waste characteristic score of 18. The hazardous waste quantity, you'll remember that was already calculated previously, so that just moves, that was already in there calculated for you. And then again, the 18 was based on moving forward with TCE. So now we're going to look at our different targets. And again, for this one, here's where you would, So this is the area that we would be looking at now, this red box where we're looking at our nearest individual, our different populations, our resources, and then our sensitive environments. So for ABC, we don't have any anything that qualifies or that we can count as level one or level two concentrations. We're assuming that we have no level one or level two. So our nearest individual is going to be associated with whatever our closest residence is. And for ABC, our closest residence is within 200 feet. We have documented that already. So that lands us in our zero to a quarter, sorry, to 1/8 mile distance from the site. So that would give us, for our nearest individual, a value of 20. And that you would just, again, select from the drop-down menu. Since we assumed that we had no level one or no level two concentrations, those would both just be zero. And we're looking at the rest of the population, and that would all be subject to potential contamination. So again, here is our, here's the HRS table 6-16. So this is showing us for level one concentrations, we could have had 50 points, level two, 45. If we have, if our nearest individual is within 0 to 1/8 of a mile, that's our 20 points. So that's how we receive 20 points for that. Greater than 1/8 to 1/4 goes to 7, 1/4 to 1/2 to 2, 1/2 mile to 1 mile, 1, and then greater than 1, you get 0 points for that. So this table here shows us how we came up with what our population is for the ABC site. So in our first column here, our distance, this is our, this is the 6 different TDLs that we're looking at within our 4 miles. So these are our 6 different distance rings. And then this is the population that we were able to determine for each one of those individual rings. So on our site, we don't have anybody that we can count as the population. From the 0 to 1/4 mile, we came up with 35 people. 1/4 to 1/2 mile, we didn't have anybody. 0.5 to 1 mile, we had almost 1,100. 1 to 2 miles, 1,254. 2 to 3 miles, 1,733. And then 3 to 4 miles, about 2,400 people. And again, this kind of just reiterates why you are doing the why you are evaluating the population in each one of your distance rings, because as you can see, each one gives you a different value to that it changes to, if that was worded properly. You know, there's a difference between if you have zero, if you have a population from 0 to 1/4 mile, and let's say you have 9 people, it's only, it takes you to 1, whereas if you're looking at the 2 to 3, you know, it takes you down that, you know, those 9 people become 0.009. So that's why you're evaluating the population in each one of your 6 distance rings. So you'll notice here, so here we had 35. You'll go over to this column. This is your number of people within the distance category. So 35 falls in this column. So your factor value is 13. Same with these. The next 4 all fall in the 1,001 to 3,000 column. So for this distance ring, you get, it drops down to 26 people. The next one, 1 to 2 miles, becomes 8. 2 to 3 becomes 4, and then finally 3 to 4 becomes 2. So your 2,400 people here went down to a factor value of 2. So your total factor value, you add, remember, you add each one of those up, and so you get 53. But then you'll remember, too, that you have to have that double whammy. So your 53 gets divided by 10 and becomes 5.3. But just to take a look, here's, again, this is where we came up with, just to show you a little bit about our population within the 0 to quarter mile range. So, again, here's our site. This is out to our quarter mile right here. And within here, we have those five residences, which we've already shown have 19 people associated with them. And we have a little bit of the crawfish ponds. Two of them are within that area. And then we have one of the warehouse complex, one of those buildings is located within that quarter mile. So, again, we have the 19 people. There's 10 people that work at the crayfish ponds, and then there's 65 that work at the warehouse complex. But as you can see, the entire warehouse complex does not fall within that quarter mile distance. So, you know, you could say that maybe 10 of those workers are associated with this building. And then again, that would be information that you'd want to follow up with during your site inspection, whatever best professional judgment you're using now to say how many people you think are associated with this one part of the warehouse, or again with the crawfish ponds, that's going to be information that you're going to want to follow up with. So we came up with that we estimated it to be about 35 people or workers that would be within this quarter mile distance ring. So that gets us, that takes care of our looking at our populations, and you can see here on line 8C for potential contamination, we've put in our 53 that we came up with, and you see where our final population, because we had no level 1 or level 2, it becomes 5.3, again, because of that final, we're looking at potential, so we had to divide that by 10, and QuickScore was nice enough to do that for you. So our population became 5.3. So now looking at our resources, again, this is, let me move ahead one, I apologize. Okay, now looking at our resources. So again, this is using best professional judgment and then something that you would want to follow up with during the site inspection if you move forward. We do have the crawfish farm that is within a half a mile of our site sources, so we could give ourselves 5 points for this. And you'll remember that resources, if you have them, it's 5 points. If you don't have them, it's 0 points. So there's nothing in between. It's either 0 or 5. So we would go ahead and we would enter from our drop-down menu, we would enter a 5 in there. And then for our sensitive environments, for ABC vacuum, we don't have any sensitive environments that are within 4 miles of our site, so we wouldn't have any points there. So we would go ahead and to get our score, it adds up our targets for us, and it looks like our targets come up to about 30.30, so that's how many points you got for targets. And then our air pathway score at this point is 2.97. So not a very big score at all, right? You went through all that work and you just came up with a site score of, or a pathway score of 2.97 for the air pathway. So it really shows you that even though you did have some decent populations in there, because you had to evaluate it on potential, you know, that distance weighting really took an effect and really, you know, really just documents, again, how that can really affect your score and how it can bring you down, and kind of shows also why the air pathway is not scored so often, because it is just hard to show that observed release to really help you get the points and then hopefully get some level 1 or level two concentrations that you can use. So that's where we stopped with the information for what we had for ABC. The next one that we're going to look at is a different scenario where we're going to go ahead and say that we have that those 35 residents or 35 people that we counted within a quarter mile of our site, that they are subject to level two concentrations. So what we would go ahead and do is you would have to also change your nearest individual, because now we're saying that we have level two concentrations. So our nearest individual for level two would get 45. We still have no level one concentrations, so that stays zero. And then our level two concentrations now goes to 35. And again, remember, that's just a straight. It's not multiplied or divided by anything. So you would get 35. You'd put 35 in your level two concentrations. And then you can see that even if we get to count some level two concentrations and we get to, you know, to increase our nearest individual score by 25 points, it's still our air pathway score comes out to be about 8.25. So it did raise it a little bit, but you can see that it just really didn't change too significantly, even though, you know, you now were able to count those 35 people at level two concentrations. So in our final scenario, we evaluated those 35 people that were within our quarter mile distance ring at level one concentrations. So now your nearest individual, we get 50 points for that because we have level one concentrations. We're counting all 35 of those at level one. So we enter our 35 in there. We don't count them as level two anymore. So that becomes a zero. And then you'll remember our 35, we get to multiply that by 10 because they're level one concentrations. So this bumps our population up to 354 when you're including your potential contamination in there. And you can see that even though we did get to count level one concentrations now, our air pathway score went up to 39.67. So again, it did increase, but it's still not really a significant change in the pathway score. It is higher than 2.97 or 8.25. But still, it doesn't make that much of a difference because, again, you're still being influenced by, you have a pretty low waste characteristic score at 18. And then, again, you only have 35 level one concentrations. And even your potential, you've been knocked down 40. And when you divide that, it's only 4. So you can still see how the air pathway, it would be hard to get a really good score unless you have, you know, an observed release that you can really document, and you have some really good populations in that 4 miles that you hopefully could count as level one or even level two concentrations, because again, the potential really does, when you have to evaluate on potential release, as you guys see, it just really can knock that score down. So that takes us to the end of the air pathway, and I guess we'll go ahead and we'll take questions, and then we can wrap it up with and talk about when our next webinar is.
Okay. So again, as a reminder, you can use the question and answer Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen to submit comments and questions. We do have a few that have come in, and I'll start with those. If you're in the middle of typing one up, don't worry. You can continue to type it away, and we should have plenty of time to try to get through anything that's in the queue. So our first question asks, if EPA approves the soil to indoor exposure pathway, would that be calculated in the air exposure pathway or in the soil exposure pathway?
We don't know the answer to that because we, you know, we haven't been involved with EPA in that. It's pre-decisional right now. They've written the proposed. We only know that the proposed rule is at OMB. So we will learn about it when you learn about it, which pathway they've decided to put VI in.
Okay. And our next question is in reference to slide 61. How did you obtain the gas source type and gas migration potential factor using the HRS rule? What assumptions were made?
Well, so those values in slide 61, this is the gas potential to release. So your containment factor values, those come out of the HRS. I will tell you I do not know which table that is, but they come out of a table, and that's where you're evaluating your containment for each one of those different sources, which actually should have already been completed. So, and you'll remember 10 is the highest value that you can get for containment factor, and then 0 is the lowest. But there's a table that provides different scenarios and then what your factor value would be. And I can get that table for you. It's just not off the top of my head right now. And then your actual, your other values are actually coming directly out of SCIDM, where you get everything else that you need to have.
Okay, I actually, believe it or not, don't see any other questions in the queue. So why don't we talk a little bit about the next webinar in the series, and we'll see if we have any other questions that pop up before we close out here in a few moments.
Okay, so the next one will actually be next Monday, July 21st. This will be Module 7, and this is where we're going to start talking about the site inspection. So you've done your preliminary assessment, you have your hypotheses, you've decided that, you know, you can move on, you have enough information to move on to the site inspection. So we're going to take a look at actually what, how to prepare for and what you actually are collecting in your activities during the site inspection. We're going to look at some of the strategies to make sure that you are collecting the correct information and getting everything you need. Mostly for Module 7, we'll be looking at the strategies for your site sources and what information do you need to collect, how do you need to collect that type of information. And then from there, we'll move forward with strategies for each one of the different pathways. But next Monday will be just what are you doing during the site inspection, and then we'll look specifically, the second part we'll look at collecting information and data related to your site sources.
Okay. Well, are there any other closing comments or thoughts you all would like to leave the audience with today before we close things out? Wait a minute. We did have one last question. My apologies. So before you think about closing comments for the audience, we have one participant that would like to know, what are the strategies when there is a lack on contaminant measurements? So I'm going to interpret that you simply don't have enough data on possible contaminants. So what approach would you take when you're missing contaminant data?
Well, I guess you'll have to tune into Modules 7 through 9. No, I'm just kidding. Again, that's where you have, you know, you've gone through, and so if you're lacking some contaminant data or concentrations, I'm going to assume that that's what contaminant measurements means. That's where you'd be collecting and during the PA. What do you need to collect during the SI to just either confirm the information or get the information? So you might need to do some additional collect some samples, either just make confirmation on some of the best professional judgments that you have used. But again, it might just be, if you don't have the data right now, it might be a simple strategy as you need to collect it, and then what do you need to collect? So is it soil sampling? Do you need to do air sampling? Do you need to do groundwater sampling?
Okay. All right. I don't see a follow-up question came in. So in other words, and this is going back to that gas source factor question. So the follow-up question is, so these values, the gas source factor and the gas migration factor values, come from SCIDM and not the HRS rule method or rule model?
I can answer because I looked them up while you were talking, Jody.
Okay, thank you.
They come from tables in the HRS rule. They don't come out of SCIDM. And the tables for gas migration are 6.3 through 6.8. There's a combination of tables that from which you collect that information out of. And then the particulate tables follow right after that, starting with 6-9. So the values that Jody was talking about come directly from a table.
Okay. I really think this is the end of the questions, but why don't we let each of you, again, any closing thoughts you want to share with the audience before we walk through the final reminders for today's broadcast?
My only thought is that, QuickScore is a great tool to run scenarios and put together hypotheses, but you got to remember to keep your notes on the other side. So what were you really sure about in QuickScore? What were you uncertain about? And what uncertainties are you going to pursue in your site inspection for your particular sites that you're evaluating? That's all for me.
Okay. And Jody, any final thoughts?
No, I think that was a good summation.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, let me go ahead and walk everybody through some final reminders. I do want to thank the over 100 individuals who joined us live from across the country, as well as a number of international participants joining us today. I also want to thank, of course, both of our talented instructors for kicking off today's session. As we've already highlighted, we just concluded module number 6. So we're going to carry on with the session next Monday with Module 7, and then there will be two more carrying the entire 9-part module series to a close on July 30th. So if you have not registered for all of the modules in the series, please be sure to do so from our CLUIN training calendar at www.cluin.org/live. You know what? We have time. Why not talk about it? If you didn't know, we have presences on a lot of social media and professional networking sites. So if you'd like to get alerted to the latest CLUIN publications as well as training opportunities, feel free to either follow us, like us, or join our groups on Facebook, LinkedIn, or Twitter. And then, of course, we do have a lookup system available online if you visit www.cluin.org/training/records, as shown on this slide. You can actually enter in your own email address, and we will send you an automated email that has a table listing all of the CLUIN webinars that you've participated in under that email address. So a lot of people find that to be helpful when trying to document or keep track of all of their training. If you have multiple email addresses or may have changed organizations and don't have access to all of the addresses you've used in the past, you're certainly welcome to send me an email at ballant.jean@epa.gov, and I'll be more than happy to pull additional training records for you. And then, of course, as mentioned at the start of today's webinar, the participant handout or slides is available on the seminar resources or links page. You'll also find a few other related documents, including the SI and PA guidance documents there to download. We will also ask that each participant take just a moment to fill out our short online feedback form. If you have multiple people participating at your location, you can each fill out your own feedback form. There'll be a link that pops up once you complete the form the first time to let someone else hop on and complete their own form. If you don't have time to fill it out today, or you're one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded versions of today's webinar, that feedback form link will be live from this point forward. So you can come back to that page, again, available off of the seminar homepage. You'll also see it under the related URLs box to the middle right. You can click on Seminar Feedback and press the Browse To button to open up that particular URL and fill that out. Just be sure when you're filling out the feedback form that you make sure your email address is entered correctly and that you check a box that's circled here in red. As long as those two things have been done, you will receive an automated email as soon as you submit the online feedback form. And for those of you that, again, are replaying the session through the recorded version, you may find that automated email is a great way to help verify or document that you did replay the entire online broadcast. As soon as we get this archive posted for module number 6, we will share an email with all of the registered participants, and you'll be welcome to pass that email on to anybody that you think will find it a valuable expenditure of their time. We do have modules 1 through 5 already posted. You can find them off of the module 6 homepage, but again, you can also email me directly, and I'll be more than happy to share the complete list of recorded sessions in this series. So with that, thank you all so very much for joining us, and I'll hopefully hear from you all next week when we carry on with module number 7 in our preliminary assessment and site inspection training. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.